This is KJZZ, your news and information station in Phoenix and across Arizona. I'm Tiara Vian, and here are this week's stories you don't want to miss. It's the podcast designed to catch you up on some highlights from around the region. Thanks for listening. Here are a few of the stories for the week of September 16th, 2024. The series, Policing the Police, that looks at the U.S. Justice Department investigation of the Phoenix Police Department, continued all this week. The U.S. Department of Justice says that what distinguishes a free country from a police state is the freedom to challenge or oppose law enforcement action. But civil rights investigators say Phoenix police retaliate against people exercising the right to free speech with violence and bogus allegations. City officials say the police department's reformed policy and protocol draws on the best practices from outside agencies, including some already being watched by the feds. Matthew Casey reports for our series, Policing the Police.
In 2021, months before the Justice Department came to town, Phoenix police were doing security for city workers cleaning an infamous part of downtown called The Zone, which held a homeless encampment. Body camera footage shows a man recording cell phone video of officers as they arrest someone. A sergeant walks over.
Can't block the sidewalk, man. You gotta keep going.
The man replies that he's allowed to stand where he is.
You're blocking the sidewalk. You need to move.
I can stand on a public sidewalk.
You need to move.
I can stand on a public sidewalk.
You need to move.
I'm outside of your area.
Okay.
The sergeant asks for the man's identification. He replies that he doesn't have any.
Am I being detained?
You are.
What am I being detained for?
For blocking a sidewalk.
I'm allowed to stand put.
As the man is being handcuffed after refusing to give his name and birth date, he says he recorded the whole encounter.
So did we. It'll be great video footage for the judge.
Records show charges against the man were dismissed. Phoenix police investigated what happened and determined that ticketing him was not within policy. In a document dated after the feds released their report, a supervisor counseled the sergeant that engaging with the man took his focus off the assignment to protect city staff.
No Trump, no KKK, no fascist USA!
No Trump!
Protesters stood against barriers downtown on a hot August night in 2017. Shortly after President Trump's rally ended, the feds say Phoenix police unleashed tear gas on peaceful protesters. Images of a man being hit with a rubber projectile went viral. Kristen Clark, Assistant Attorney General for Civil Rights, says Phoenix police made a souvenir that's usually a memento for bravery.
This challenge coin instead depicted a protester whom an officer shot in the groin with a 40-millimeter impact round.
The feds say the coin contains hate speech, and Phoenix police were still celebrating the incident in training sessions years later.
When police officers abuse their power to silence people asserting their constitutional rights to free speech and assembly, it erodes the community's trust in law enforcement.
In 2020, as the pandemic raged, the killing of George Floyd by Minneapolis police drew protests across the country. City of Phoenix officials say the size, intensity, and duration of local demonstrations was unprecedented. Scandal struck again when it emerged that police falsely accused one group of protesters of being in a street gang.
This has been kind of a long-standing thing. We've known the city has major civil rights problems.
Attorney Steve Benedetto represents people hit with bogus gang allegations who sued the city after their cases were dismissed. Benedetto says actions by Phoenix police communicated that felony charges were the cost of criticizing law enforcement under the First Amendment.
That was the message that was sent, and it left a mark. The vast majority of the folks that we represented that had gone out for like one or two protests have not protested again.
Phoenix acknowledges both scandals as times when police fell short in their treatment of protesters. A big change the city highlights for the feds is Phoenix police having remade the protest response unit.
The last 2 years, we've had a number of protests since I've been here. And what I've seen is our officers do what they're supposed to do, is protect people's First Amendment rights and their ability to protest.
Interim Chief Michael Sullivan says new policies set a clear line between what is activity protected by the First Amendment and civil disturbance. Efforts in Phoenix, officials told the feds, are in line with reforms and recommendations made in other places.
Yeah, I think it's important for the Department of Justice to know that we were looking at what was going on in other cities.
The feds mentioned Sullivan by name 13 times in their report, acknowledging his reform efforts. Sullivan says he draws no message from it, as his focus is on continuous improvement. Matthew Casey, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
And you can find the entire series at police.kjzz.org. In health news, the annual Abilities Expo recently came to Phoenix, where over the course of 3 days, local vendors and buyers had the chance to highlight new technology to help people with disabilities. Kirsten Dorman was there and has this story.
Dave Stevens grew up in Wickenburg, Arizona, but from college football to the MLB, his career as an athlete has taken him all over the country.
It was a dream come true, you know, and I became the only guy without legs ever to play college football, so I've done something nobody on this earth has ever done.
Stevens recently returned to the Valley to be part of the annual Abilities Expo.
Everybody has something that's a little different with them, and they can kind of breathe and relax and go, hey, we're amongst our homies, we're with our peers.
He says at the expo, people with disabilities become the majority, and both their needs and capabilities are truly front and center.
Really need the world, the outside world, to see that, again, you can become disabled at any time. So keep those minds open for what if I need this down the road, or what if I need this in advancing age.
Stevens says the event isn't just about showcasing products.
Don't pity those of us that have seen and unseen disabilities. Embrace us.
He says it's a space that others could take notes from, free of pointed looks, stares, and stigma.
It's such a great 3-day event of camaraderie. But it also teaches empathy instead of sympathy.
Stevens says being able to learn and think creatively about different kinds of disabilities is the crux of making technology that's accessible and useful. An engineer by trade, Kelly Ferguson began experimenting with his 3D printer.
The 3D printing
right here. At the base level,
in the morning, you can have the actual thing in your hand, like an hour later.
It became increasingly common for people to stop him about the articulated cup holder he designed to slide under the cushion of his wheelchair. It's designed for wheelchair users to easily carry drinks.
So, like, make it myself because I cannot find what I need. It's like,
That's his wife, Karen Ferguson. Together, they create items to assist people with limited dexterity or use of their hands. Down to opening doors or brushing your teeth, the right product can make a huge difference. A former interior designer, Karen makes sure the products look good on top of being functional, like their multi-adapter tool, which comes in a variety of colors and sizes.
And when they come with little inserts, you can change it out. You can do a pen, pencil, marker, toothbrush.
Karen says that while some high-tech products and solutions are cool, they don't take into account how everyday use would really look.
I don't think we need, like, they come out with, like, you know, like, the giant, like, exoskeleton thing, where it's, like, you know, 30,000, I don't know how much it is. Yeah, it's one of those things where it's a really nice idea, but cost-wise, I don't think a lot of disabled people are going to be able to afford it, which is always, you know, a tough one.
And she says balancing cost with quality of living is a big factor.
Companies make these, like, grand designs, and it's like, let's just scale it back and make something that is more affordable.
And more practical.
Stevens echoed that sentiment.
That's where we're working with politicians and people like that to try to lower these costs, because you can get up and go run on the beach. People in wheelchairs can't do that. But there's equipment here that could allow them to do that. And you want to be able to give these people those opportunities.
But insurance coverage and cost often stand in the way. Karen says that's why when it comes to their designs, they focus on feedback and keeping prices low. Kelly says the design space overall could use more people with disabilities in it and could stand to listen to them more. He says that for him, part of owning what he brings to the table with his disability rather than in spite of it meant
realizing you can do more than you think, and you just have to practice trial and error. That's the whole thing.
Stevens says he hopes more people will recognize the inherent value of those with seen and unseen disabilities.
It's tough to have confidence when you have a disability, because you already have a strike or two against you is how you look or how you walk or those kind of things. So
he says the event shines a light on skills and abilities that often get overlooked.
Anything that you can do to overcome that and get that confidence, so you want to go out and get a job, you want to go out and date somebody, you want to go out and do all these things that this expo can expose you to, it really is awesome.
Kirsten Dorman, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
In education news, Chronic absenteeism has increased in schools in the years following the COVID-19 pandemic. As Greg Hawney reports, a local organization is working with cities and communities to improve messaging around the issue.
About 28% of Arizona students were chronically absent in the 2022-23 school year, meaning they missed at least 10% of their classes. Students who were economically disadvantaged had higher rates. In the school year before the pandemic began, it was at about 13%. Valley of the Sun United Way worked with the City of Phoenix, ASU, and other groups to develop a toolkit to improve communications and get students back in schools. Don Gerundo is with Valley of the Sun United Way.
Being aware is not the only solution, but it's enough to help us move to the next level and really put our resources in place for those that need them.
The toolkit includes fact sheets, statistics, and suggested methods to communicate with parents. Greg Hawney, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
And this is the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast. Thanks for listening. Every Wednesday, KJZZ offers up hotspots to spice up your weekend. It's delivered right to your phone. Try something new or step out of the routine. Just visit hotspots.kjzz.org to sign up. In Tribal Natural Resources, which is supported in part by a grant from the Katina Foundation. Grand Canyon National Park just announced that 100 buffalo from the North Rim have been captured and relocated with the help of an intertribal group. Gabriel Pietrazio has more.
Last summer marked the first time since the roundups began that no buffalo were captured. Too much moisture in the air masked the scent of bait used to trap the bison. But now more than 300 buffalo have been removed from the North Rim since 2018. Most of them went to 8 tribes through the Intertribal Buffalo Council, an indigenous-led group that stewards the species on their homelands. Every September, they partner with the National Park Service to reduce Arizona's herd as a management strategy. The park estimates that the North Rim herd had been made up of roughly 380 animals this summer. Gabriel Pietrazio, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
Now from KJZZ's original production. Podcaster and comedian Mark Maron hit a new level of vulnerability in his stand-up. Here's the show's Sam Dingman and Mark Brody.
You know, as happens from time to time here on the show, recently I got the chance to talk to one of my heroes, Mark Maron. You're familiar with his work as well, if I'm not mistaken.
His stand-up comedian's got a very popular podcast called WTF.
That's right. WTF has been running since 2009, gets millions of downloads every week. I'm not ashamed to admit I have never missed an episode. But I'm also a huge fan of Maron's stand-up comedy, and I have been particularly interested in his more recent material. Last year, he released an HBO special called From Bleak to Dark, and it got a lot of critical acclaim for this one sequence where he talks about the death of his girlfriend, the filmmaker Lynn Shelton. In particular, there's this one moment where he talks about how surreal it felt to grieve Lynn's loss.
I'm just sitting on my porch, and a hummingbird came right up to my head, just like, and I'm like, oh my God, Lynn! Lynn, you're a hummingbird now! Of course you are! That makes so much sense! I miss you, baby. I can't believe you're a hummingbird. What's that like? That's crazy. And then the next day, there were like 4 hummingbirds. I'm like, what the fuck is happening? Which one is Lynn? Who's Lynn? Is this like Lynn and her new dead friends? Is this what happens?
Now, obviously, I was already in the tank for Maron, and I've always found his work to be just as emotionally rich as it is hilarious. But that moment in the special kind of made me feel like he'd found a new gear.
That is interesting. He is coming to Phoenix this weekend. He'll be performing at the Orpheum Theater. Sam, as you mentioned, got a chance to catch up with him earlier this week. Let's take a listen.
You know, I feel like I heard you mention on the show not so long ago that this current run of stand-up that you're doing, building up to your next special,
yeah,
might potentially be your last run.
You know, I say that, I think, all the time. You know, as sort of a preparation for when I actually mean it. Mm-hmm. After a certain point, because of the way I do stand up, I just get concerned that, you know, the resource of me is going to dry up at some point.
Sure. Well, let me ask you more about that. I'm really fascinated by what you said about this idea of whether or not the self is a renewable resource, because you've always spoken very personally. But
yeah,
more and more so in your recent work, there's been this vulnerability to it.
And I'm thinking in particular, obviously, of in your most recent special, From Bleak to Dark, talking about your grief about losing Lynn and the hummingbird moment. And I know that in this current hour, if I'm not mistaken, you're talking very openly about some potentially traumatic stuff from childhood. Does that feel like a different register for you than where you've been previously?
Yeah, totally. I mean, it seems to be like the new frontier on some level. I think talking about grief and tragedy in Bleak to Dark just sort of gave me some sort of portal into knowing that I could elevate other things that were, you know, utterly personal or painful and bring them to a point of humor. I know like it's a buzzword, you know, vulnerability, authenticity, you know, trauma talk or whatever.
Yeah.
But I also think it's kind of loaded in a way that is truly kind of risk-taking and truly kind of edgy. But I think ultimately, if you've got something that's stuck in you, you know, from childhood or from pain or from tragedy or from grief, and there's some little key that makes you laugh at it, that does wonders to integrate it into the wholeness of your being, you know?
Yeah. Well, so can I ask you, and you don't have to go into any more detail, I don't want to ruin the show, obviously, but in terms of this material that you're working with in the current hour, did you find that you were able to experience these memories in a comedic sense for the first time on stage?
Well, no, because, you know, me and my, you know, my brother had talked about it for a long time here and there. And, you know, the outcome of it, I think I have a brain that is constantly in a state of, you know, mild panic, and kind of, you know, manufactures crisis as a way of self-soothing. I make myself a little crazy with it all, you know. But I recently realized that when you have that kind of brain, when an actual crisis happens, you're kind of ready to go. You know, so
so fringe benefit, maybe.
Yeah. But my point is that I chose a long time ago, you know, to stay away from, you know, topicality in a broad sense, because you'll notice that, you know, the way comics handle, certainly the anti-woke comics, you know, handle what they consider edgy material is essentially just reconfiguring talking points, you know, kind of like, hey, we can't say anything anymore. And so for me, the only way to kind of move against being a hack in that way seems to be like going inside to myself and talking about how I think and what I think about in my experience. That's really the only way to go to maintain originality. So
absolutely,
that's where I'm at.
Well, and there's a big difference between, you know, throwing this word vulnerability around. There's a big difference between the kind of anti-woke comic you're talking about, claiming that they are making themselves vulnerable by, in their minds, exposing themselves to cancellation, versus you actually being vulnerable in processing this traumatic experience in a comedic way that people may not have seen before. That's a very different version of vulnerability.
Well, I appreciate that. You know, I always saw being a stand-up as being, you know, something more than an entertainer. And it is sort of like, you know, I do think about the world constantly. I am constantly engaged with the news. I'm constantly engaged with myself and where I'm at in my life. And so it all kind of, you know, moves together.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's interesting hearing you characterize it that way because, you know, in getting ready to talk to you today, I was thinking about one of my favorite, like, Marc Maron sort of political jokes ever, when this is a very old one, but the joke was, you always think the sound of Big Brother is going to be this like big booming voice, but the sound of Big Brother is just some guy going like, hey, check it out. My phone has GPS.
Yeah.
Still one of my favorite Marc Maron jokes. But I was trying to think about like, why did that joke work so well for me? And I think it was because, and tell me if you agree with this, if memory serves, it comes in the context of you being at, I think it's like the Creationism Museum and being annoyed at people in line being idiots with their phones. So it's like the joke lands because it comes in the context of this very personal experience that you've had.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's the way I process everything. And I had to honor that point of view in my comedy. You know, like, look, you know, there's guys who have personas and I don't know that I have one. And it used to really bother me, you know, be like, how do I get a persona? you know, but I think the struggle has always been to be me, and I'm pretty painfully me.
Yeah. Well, one of the other things, I guess, that has been fascinating to me about this thing that I hear you saying is sometimes how you feel and sometimes not how you feel in terms of, are you coming to the end of the time when you want to be doing this, is just in relation to what you were saying about stand-up and the desire to be more than just an entertainer. What do you feel like stand-up is fulfilling for you now?
You know, there was always sort of this drive, you know, to get the new joke, to figure out a new thing, and I was always like, you know, really intent on, you know, making people see things the way I did or see things differently or blowing minds or coming up with a new bit. So there is always an element of discovery that is sort of unparalleled by any other experience in life, because I do generate, you know, live on stage most of the time. So it's sort of delivered to me by something I don't really understand. And that, you know, is a creative catharsis that is still available to me. And I think as long as it's available to me and it continues to happen, you know, I'll continue doing it.
Yeah.
Like that bit that we were talking about earlier, that point of view around technology and around our surrender of our own minds, you know, still holds. I'm doing a bit now that I'm working on about how I believe no matter, you know, what your life looks like or what your personal life looks like, that I'd argue that your primary emotional partner is probably your phone.
Well, yeah, I mean, I was thinking about, you know, if I was to think of the broad arc of Marc Maron politics throughout your work, the thing that's always resonated for me, at least, is that it always feels like you're talking about what has power over us and how we give it that power. And it's occurring to me as we're talking that in a way there's a real continuity between the idea that sometimes the thing you're giving power to is a government or a politician or a certain type of comedy or a device, but that as you begin to integrate more of your own emotional experience, it's also acknowledging that sometimes you're giving your trauma power over you, or sometimes you're navigating the power that your trauma has over you. So there is kind of a continuity there.
Yeah. So sadly, though, you know, pushing back on power outside of you, you know, is easier than pushing back on power inside of you. And sometimes you know, you're going to buckle to that inner one, and it can really screw your life up for as long as it takes, maybe forever.
All right. Well, Marc Maron will be at the Orpheum Theater here in Phoenix this Saturday. Marc, thank you so much for taking this time. I appreciate it.
Great job, buddy. I enjoyed it. Thanks, man.
In business news, new state laws effective in January will require cities to allow casitas and the conversion of eligible commercial, office, or mixed-use buildings for multifamily homes. As Jill Ryan reports, now Scottsdale is seeking public input to update its zoning code, which includes some state-allowed restrictions.
Scottsdale opposed the laws, arguing during the legislative process that local governments are better able to handle housing issues while balancing community opinion and the character of the town. But now it must comply by January. Scottsdale seeks to add city-specific restrictions to limit which areas or buildings will be affected by those laws. In two city-made videos, they propose to use the fullest extent of what the state will allow to limit the impact of incoming casitas and multifamily housing. One video also says that if the city does not comply by January, casitas will be allowed on all residential lots or parcels without limits. Jill Ryan, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
And finally, Infronteras News. Department of Labor Acting Secretary Julie Sue was in Tucson this week talking to local leaders and workers about the newly proposed federal heat protections. How would that impact Arizona? From the Fronteras desk in Tucson, Elisa Resnick has more.
Jim Frederick is the Principal Deputy Assistant Secretary at OSHA. He says about half of U.S. states have implemented what's called a state plan with OSHA.
And then that state has the legal authority to implement workplace health and safety. Arizona is one of those states that have done that.
But Frederick says Arizona doesn't currently have its own heat standards within that state plan. A program implemented last year allows state workplace inspectors to visit work sites and ensure they're safe from heat hazards. But there's no official baseline for what is considered adequate protections. Frederick says the new federal rule would require state regulations that are at least as stringent as the federal ones, and would also require employers to come up with a plan to recognize and respond to heat injuries. Elisa Resnick, KJZZ News, Tucson.
And and this has been the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast. It's made possible in part by Helios Education Foundation and Alliance Bank, the Vitalist Health Foundation, the Intel Corporation and Beach Fleischman, the Arizona Community Foundation, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Thank you for listening to KJZZ and for your generous support. I'm Tiara Vian. This is KJZZ, your news and information station.